To the book of Mark, chapter 6. Mark 6. And the section we're looking at right now is Mark chapter 6, beginning with verse 45 through 52. And as we go through the book, we'll look at the various blocks of text and put a caption on them. We will call this the Lord of the Sea. The Lord of the Sea. Mark chapter 6, verse 45 through verse 52. This is the incident where Jesus comes walking on the water and proves himself to be the Lord of the Sea. We will divide it into two parts. First of all, the setting. The setting is very important. It's Mark 6, 45 through 47. And let's read through those verses to get the setting for this miracle. Verse 45. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side of Bethsaida, while he himself was sending the multitude away. And after bidding them farewell, he departed to the mountain to pray. And when it was evening, and here is the important part of the setting, the boat was in the midst of the sea, and he was alone on the land. So the setting is very important. The setting is Jesus on land, disciples at sea. That is the critical, that is the crux of the whole narrative at this point. Jesus and the disciples were separated. They were in two different places, and this will become very significant as far as the narrative is concerned. That is followed with the miracle itself. 6:48 through 52. And the miracle, as we read through, we'll find breaks down into five parts. Number one, we'll label the appearance. The disciples at sea, and we have the appearance of the Lord. Mark 6:48. Seeing them straining at the oars, for the wind was against them, at about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea, and he intended to pass by them. So we have in verse 48 the appearance of Jesus. As the narrative continues, the emphasis then shifts to the perception of the disciples, what they thought they saw. And their perception is in verse 49. When they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed that it was a ghost. Interesting word for ghost in Greek. It's the Greek word phantasma. We've got it in English, fantasy. They supposed it was a fantasy, or as our translation gives us, a ghost, and cried out. That is their perception. That is followed by Jesus issuing a command. And his command is found in verse 50, which reads, "For they all saw him and were frightened, but immediately he spoke with them and said to them, 'Take courage, it is I, do not be afraid.'" The command is then followed by the calm. Mark 6, verse 51, which reads, "He got into the boat with them, the wind stopped, and they were greatly astonished." Then the narrative closes out with a commentary in verse 52. And the commentary tells us something about the disciples. Verse 52 reads, "They," the disciples, "had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened." And therefore, breaking down into five parts, the miracle we're looking at in Mark chapter 6. So let's begin with that kind of outline to start with the appearance of Jesus first, and then note the features of it. Verse 48. There are two incidents that are involved in Mark concerning Jesus and the sea. And those two incidents, one of which we have already studied, are very instructive. The first one is Mark 4:35, and let's mark where we are in the text and go back to that. Mark 4 and verse 35. Verse 35 through verse 41. In this particular instance, we read in verse 35 that on that day, when evening had come, he says to them, "Let us go to the other side." And they leave the multitude, and as they go out into the middle of Galilee, a storm rises, and Jesus is asleep, and they feel that they're going to perish. And we've come down to verse 39, that being aroused, he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush, be still." Two words in Greek, the word hush, which means to be silent, and the word be still, which means to be muzzled. The emphasis or the stress in this emphasis is on the words of Jesus or the power of his word. And you can see that coming off of verse 39, because as he says, "Hush, be still," the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. Emphasis, power of Jesus' word. The second incident, the one we're looking at today, is the one in Mark 6, 45 through 52. And it also pertains to Jesus and the sea. However, the stress is different, because notice in Mark chapter 6, if you come down to verse 48, "Seeing them straining at the oars, for the wind was against them, at about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea and intended to pass by them." Notice, he says nothing. You come down to verse 51, and as far as the storm is concerned, no comment is made. And in verse 51, he got into the boat with them. And notice there is no "hush, be still" like any other context. But he got in the boat with them, and the wind stopped, and they were greatly astonished. So if Mark 4 stresses the power of his word, Mark 6 stresses the power of his presence or his person. He said nothing pertaining to the storm in Mark 6, and therefore we've got an emphasis on simply because he was present, simply because of the power of his person, the storm subsided when he took his place in the boat. Also notice that as we begin in Mark 6, that in verse 46, that he had bid the disciples farewell and the multitude farewell, and he departed to the mountain to pray. In the book of Mark, there is a direct relationship in Jesus' life between intense activity and withdrawal to pray. So let's put down two words that will summarize. There is a relationship in Mark that he notes in three places between intense activity followed by private prayer, so that we can demonstrate that the Lord will have a tremendously busy day, very active, doing a great deal of things, and then suddenly at the end of that day, he will withdraw. And he will withdraw for private prayer. And I think that carries with it a very important lesson, that even the Son of God himself needed to withdraw from the activity of his day for personal reflection and for personal prayer. Go back to Mark 1 and we'll demonstrate that. Mark 1. Mark 1. Now, beginning in Mark 1, we have probably one of the busiest days in all of the ministry of Jesus. Starting at chapter 1 and verse 16, it says, "And as he, Jesus, was going by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, and he calls them." And in verse 21, continuing the same day, it says, "They went to Capernaum. And immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and began to teach. And as he teaches, a demon-possessed man cries out." He handles the situation. And you come down to verse 29. immediately after they'd come out of the synagogue. They came to the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John, and there they find Simon's mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. The Lord heals her, and verse 32, when evening had come, same day yet, when evening had yet come, after the sun had set, he began bringing to him all who were ill and those who were demon-possessed, and the whole city had gathered at the door, still on the same day. And he healed many who were ill with various diseases, cast out many demons, and he was not permitting the demons to speak because they knew who he was. And, verse 35, in the early morning, same day, while it was still dark, he arose, went out, departed to a lonely place, and he was praying there. So notice, up through verse 16 down to verse 34, you have intense activity on the part of Jesus. Then suddenly, when you come down to verse 35, early that next morning, he withdraws to pray. And that's the pattern, that intense activity is always broken up with private withdrawal and prayer. Look at Mark 6, 34. Probably if a person knows just a limited amount of the miracles that Jesus performed, one of them that everybody knows about is the feeding of the 5,000. And on that particular day, you've had a great deal of activity, and you come down to Mark chapter 6, verse 34. And disembarking, he saw a great multitude, felt compassion for them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And you have the day of teaching, then you have the feeding of the 5,000, and then notice at the end of that, you come down to Mark chapter 6 and verse 45. Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat, go ahead of him to the other side to Bethsaida, while he himself was sending the multitude away. After bidding them farewell, he departed to the mountain to pray. Intense activity followed by private prayer is the pattern. Mark 14 has the same pattern again. The intense activity was the activity of the summoning of the 12 disciples and the Last Supper. Verse 17, when it was evening, he came with the 12, and as they were reclining at the table and eating, Jesus said, "Truly I say to you that one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." Had to be a tense situation. And then you come down, and that is broken up with the 32nd verse, where it says, they came to a place named Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here till I have prayed." And he withdraws himself from the busy activity of the day, and he withdraws for private prayer. And again, the lesson involved is that the activity was broken up by time for quiet reflection and prayer to his heavenly Father. All right, looking now at the setting in chapter 6, verse 45. Focusing around Jesus' appearance to the disciples. Chapter 6, verse 47. When it was evening, the boat was in the midst of the sea, and he was alone on the land. So you've got a separation of Jesus and the disciples. Now, at this point, there's an interesting feature of the book of Mark that comes out. And it all revolves about the fact that Jesus was one place, the disciples were another. And it is simply this. Whenever Jesus is absent, or perceived to be absent, the disciples find themselves in distress. Whenever Jesus is absent, whenever there is separation, either real or perceived, the disciples find themselves in distress. So let's abbreviate it for writing. When Jesus is absent, the disciples are in distress. Or they know distress. And I'll underscore the word distress, because that leads us to a second feature of Mark, and that is this. Whenever they're in distress, it's because they lack faith. So distress that they experience when he is absent is inevitably due to lack of faith. Let me state the points once again, and then we'll demonstrate them from the text. One of the features of the book of Mark that he notes is whenever Jesus is actually absent or separated from the disciples, or when they think he is. In this particular chapter, he is actually physically separate from them. There in the sea, he's on the land. Whenever that happens in the book of Mark, you're going to find the disciples in distress. And inevitably, Jesus will trace that distress many times by direct words and by saying, the reason you're in distress is your lack of faith. Now, why do you think in the book of Mark and elsewhere in the Gospels, why would Jesus ever purposely be absent from his disciples? And there's a lesson involved in it, and it's a very important lesson, and that is this. The day is coming very quickly when he will die, be raised, and he will ascend, and they will be on earth without his physical presence. And you recall the last words of the book of Matthew? He says, lo, I am with you even to the end of the age. So they're beginning to get some beginning lessons, is that you have to recognize the Lord's presence when he is physically absent. And isn't that a lesson as far as we're concerned? The Lord is very present to us, but not physically. He's here, but he's not seen. And therefore, we have to learn that perception of his presence is one that comes about by faith. Now, for a demonstration of this, go back to Mark 4. Mark 4. Two points. Whenever Jesus is absent or perceived to be absent, the disciples are in distress. Whenever they are in distress, it is due to lack of faith. Chapter 4, verse 38. In this context, as far as they were concerned, the Lord wasn't there. He was asleep, and they perceived that he wasn't really aware of their situation. So verse 38 says, he himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and they awoke him and said, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? And the emphasis is, you are disregarding us. And notice, because of that perception that the Lord might as well not even be in the boat for all the attention he's giving us, they know distress, and notice he links that coming down to verse 40. He said to them, why are you so timid or fearful? How is it that you have no faith? They perceived Jesus not to be aware of their situation. They were in distress. The distress was due to lack of faith. Very practical lesson. There are many, many times when we are in a pressure situation and our perception is very simple. The Lord is paying no attention to me. Haven't you ever had Jesus asleep in your boat when everything's going down and he's paying no attention to you? And that's the perception, just like theirs. And what do you get when you're in that situation, when you do not actually perceive the Lord's presence? You get distress. And what is the distress due to? Lack of faith that he is actually with us. Chapter 6. Same situation. The separation is stated, as we've already read, in verses 46 and 47. Then you come down to verse 49, and you see their fright. When they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed that it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were frightened. The Lord and the disciples were separated from one another. Verse 50, they were frightened. And what is it due to? Verse 52, they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. Jesus was separate from them. They were plunged into distress, and it is linked to lack of faith. Go over to chapter 9. Chapter 9 of Mark. This is verses 2 through 19. Several of the disciples have been taken away for the transfiguration. Verse 2 says, 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John. That, of course, would leave 9 of the disciples and brought them up to a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. So notice the setting is Jesus and 9 of his disciples are separated. Whenever the disciples are literally separated from the Lord, or they perceive themselves to be separated from the Lord, they always get into a distressed situation, and the distressed situation is inevitably due to lack of faith. Well, notice the mess they get into, because when Jesus, Peter, James, and John come back, if you move down to verse 14, it says when they came back to the disciples, that would be 9 of them, they saw a large crowd around them, and you could almost guess they've got to be in trouble. They always got in trouble of a distressed nature when they were separated from the Lord. And verse 15 says, immediately when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed, began running to greet them. And he asked them, what are you discussing with them? That is the disciples. One of the crowd answered and said, teacher, I brought you my son, possessed with a spirit which makes him mute. And I brought them to the disciples. And last sentence, verse 18, I told your disciples to cast it out, and they could not do it. And you can imagine the distress that they're involved in. And notice the Lord analyzes their distress. In verse 20, or verse 19, he answering them and said, O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me. Jesus absent, disciples in distress, problem, lack of faith. So this is the thing they're going to begin to learn, and they will learn, at least attempt to learn, on this little incident we're looking at this morning. So let's go back to chapter 6 now. Verse 48. And this is the appearance now of Jesus. Seeing them straining at the oars, by the way, the word seeing has to refer to a supernatural seeing. 2 reasons. Number 1, it was the fourth watch of the night. That would be 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. or sunup. How could he see them in the darkness of the night? Second, John adds a little note in saying that they were about 3.5 miles out to sea. So how in the middle of the night is the Lord going to see them straining at the oars, looking out there for 3.5 miles? And the answer would simply be, he could not on a natural basis. So seeing them is a supernatural element showing that he is perfectly aware of where they were at all times. As he sees them, he goes out and begins to walk on the sea. And the last part of verse 48 says he intended to pass by them. Now, what does that mean? Why did he intend to pass by them? The emphasis is that he was on a course that was going to cause him to bypass the boat. Why would the Lord intend to pass by? Well, perhaps one explanation, and it's probably the simplest one, and it would be very characteristic of the Lord. You want me in the boat? Ask. In other words, he was going by the boat because he wanted them to invite them into the boat, and that is very possible. However, it's also very possible that when we read in verse 48, he intended to pass by, that the words pass by have a significant meaning to them. The words pass by, if we look at them in the Old Testament sense, they are the words that were used for a theophany. Pass by are words for a theophany. In the Old Testament, a theophany simply means an appearance of God. And in the Old Testament, frequently when God made an appearance and revealed himself to someone, the words would be, the Lord passed by. Let's go to 2 places that will demonstrate it. Exodus chapter 33 first. Exodus 33. Could very well be that the Lord was trying to take the disciples back to Old Testament ground. In Exodus 33, verse 18, we have the following words. Then Moses said, I pray thee, show me thy glory. And he said, I will make all my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim the name of Yahweh before you, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, will show compassion on whom I will show compassion. But he said, you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. So we've got a theophany. And God is going to say, in appearing to you, Moses, I'm going to pass by you. 1 Kings 19. In 1 Kings 19, we've got another theophany. And notice the terminology beginning down at verse 10. He, Elijah, said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, torn down thine altars. Do you have a... Is your New American have the word altar misspelled? Just notice that. I've got A-L-T-E-R, do you? Yeah. How many do? You got the misspelled? Yeah. Okay, well, let's take our pencils and correct the Bible this morning. Should be an altar, A-L-T-A-R. Torn down thine altars and kill thy prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. So he, the Lord, said, go forth, stand on the mountain before the Lord, and behold, the Lord was passing by. And you have it described in the following context. So notice the words pass by in the Old Testament are words for a theophany. So it could be very well that as the Lord is walking out toward the boat, he is going to pass by it and want their minds to go back to Elijah, to go back to Moses, and note that we are seeing an appearance of God himself. In other words, it's a demonstration of his character as none other than the Son of God. Well, as he passes by, the disciples have a perception. And their perception is found in the following words of verse 49. As we noted when we read through the passage, verse 49 says, when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost and cried out. And again, the thing to note is the word that is translated ghost in English is the Greek word phantasma. And we bring the word phantasma over into English with the word fantasy, and it simply means an apparition. A very real apparition scared them to death. There was a popular belief that spirits of the night brought disaster. Let me read a little section here out of the Jewish Talmud, and the narrative goes like this. It says, seafarers have told me that the wave that sinks a ship appears with a white fringe of fire at its crest, and when stricken with clubs, imagine out there beating waves, but when stricken with clubs on which is engraven, quote, I am that I am, Yahweh the Lord of hosts, it subsides. So whatever weight that may have had, that at least reflects some of the current Jewish thinking, that if you will beat on a wave with I am or Yahweh on it, that the wave will subside. And so the disciples could well have been filled with lots of superstition, and perhaps even this thing was in their mind. Well, as they perceive that the Lord is a ghost, the Lord comes along and issues a command. And the command is found in verses 50 and 51. Verse 50, for they all saw him and were frightened, but immediately he spoke with them and said to them, take courage, it is I, do not be afraid. The words, it is I, are very, very important. They translate the Greek word ego, eimi, E-G-O, then separate word, E-I-M-I. The word ego is the emphatic personal pronoun I. So I'll put the word I and I'll simply heavily underscore it. All Greek verbs have the subject in them. For example, if we would say, he looses, would look something like that, lu-a. And if you would say, lu-o, notice all one word, this is I loose, and that is he looses. Notice the subject is part of the word. Whenever they want to make the subject strong, they separate it from the word. So that a me over here means I am. And the Lord wants to stress the I part of the verb. So it is I am. And our translation has given us it is I. And literally what the Lord said in verse 50 is take courage, I am. Now that in turn ought to take us back to Old Testament, because in the book of Exodus, without going to it, chapter 3, verse 14, Moses asked the Lord, what is his name? And the Lord replies to that, what is my name? By saying, I am that I am. As a matter of fact, what we call the Hebrew tetragrammaton, which is God's name, that looks something like that in Hebrew, which is made up of a Y and an H sound and a W sound and an H sound, reading from right to left, and that's where we fill in and get the word Yahweh there. And that word Yahweh is simply very much like that word we saw in Greek Ami, which means I am. And therefore, when the Lord comes on in verse 50 and says, take courage, I am, he is making an enormous claim. Now, the words I am, notice, are connected and really bracketed in verse 50 with take courage, do not be afraid. So the emphasis is I am is present. And very frequently in the Old Testament, when there is emphasis that the Lord is present, it is attached with a therefore implication. And the therefore implication that is there, do not fear. And the thinking many places in the Old Testament is, look, I'm here. Therefore, you do not need to fear. Let's look at that in some places. Psalm 118. Psalm 118. I am is literally the antidote to fear. Psalm 118. Verses 5 and 6. Psalm 118, verses 5 and 6. From my distress I called upon the Lord. And remember, we know the word Yahweh is there when we have Lord set all in uppercase capital letters. From my distress I called upon I am. I am answered me and set me in a large place. I am is for me. I will not fear. And notice between, though we've got in verse 6, we've got the Lord is for me, semicolon, then I will not fear. The semicolon implies a therefore, does it not? So the Lord is, I am is for me, therefore I will not fear. A link. I am is present, therefore we do not need to fear. Isaiah 41. Isaiah 41. I am connected frequently in the Old Testament to the fact that we do not need to fear. I am infers that we can have courage. Isaiah 41, verse 13. For I am your God, who upholds your right hand, who says to you, do not fear. I will help you. Notice the connection? I am is present. Therefore, the inference is we do not need to fear. Without going to them, you have the same thing in chapter 43, verse 1, 43, 3, 43, 5, 44:2, etc., many times in the Old Testament. All right, let's go back now to Mark 6. And notice that the command is followed with the calm. And we hardly need to comment on verse 51 because it is so dramatic. Chapter 6, 51 says, he got into the boat with them. Notice, by the way, the Lord supported the disciples two ways, by word in verse 50 and by presence in verse 51. He got into the boat with them and the wind stopped. And they were greatly astonished, and the calm settles. We then move to the commentary on the event. The commentary is verse 52. For they had not gained any insight. Wait a minute, isn't it great to be able to identify with these biblical characters? It's just like you're looking into a mirror, because many times we will experience some of the care and protection of God, and what do we gain? Nothing. They didn't either. For they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. In other words, they'd seen the feeding of the 5,000, but they didn't see its significance. They didn't see what it meant to them. They didn't see who it taught him to be. Now, let me make a remark at this point in closing. At this point in the life of Jesus, the disciples are really no different in their mentality than Jesus' opponents. You look down at verse 52 and they gain no insight. Their heart was hardened. How are they different than the opponents of Jesus? And the answer is, at this point, they are not. You will say, well, there's got to be some difference. Think it through. Their heart was hardened. They had no insight, and there are other passages that show this same thing. How then were they different from the opponents of Jesus? Only one point that made them different. They weren't religious. All of the Pharisaic opponents of Jesus were religious, hung up on religious tradition. The disciples were very irreligious men. The Pharisees had a hard time with them. Remember, these guys were so irreligious, they walked through a field and they plucked ears of corn and the Pharisees fell apart. You're breaking the Sabbath? Peter probably looked up and said, who cares? You know, I'm not that religious. And you will have them, this guy Matthew that the Lord calls, or Levi that the Lord calls, gets so excited he throws a party and invites some of the disreputable people in the city. And they all sit there and the Pharisees peek in and say, how can you sit there with sinners? We don't understand it. You invite the wrong people to your parties. They were very irreligious. But I think that is the very thing that saved the disciples. They were not hung up on religion. And our next study will be in Mark 7, verses 1 through 23, which will in essence be this. The Pharisees had a whole body of legalistic tradition, and Jesus totally disregarded it. And we'll have a clash that you wouldn't believe in Mark chapter 7, and we'll have a passage about how Jesus completely ignores and how he completely repudiates all of their legalistic tradition. We'll pick that up in our next study. Father, we're thankful today for your word and your truth. We're thankful for the person of Jesus Christ, who is the great I Am, the Eternal Father. And we're thankful because of your presence and the promise of your word that we need not fear, and we can face life with an inner calm and a mental stability that is only possible when we have a relationship with you through your word and through your Son, Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.